Hey everyone, welcome to the Faith Chapel podcast. We are so glad to have you join us. Faith Chapel exists to help people follow Jesus, be transformed by Jesus, and be on mission with Jesus. No matter where you are on your spiritual journey, you're welcome here. If you have any questions about who we are or what you hear, you can visit faithchapel.cc or email podcast@faithchapel.cc. We'd love to hear from you. All right, let's dive into this week's message. So 1 Corinthians chapter 2, we on occasion will take time just to dig into a book of the Bible, and that's what we're doing during this season. 1 Corinthians is a series of letters. There are apparently are four of them. We have two of them contained here in the Bible, and they're letters from the Apostle Paul to his friends and to a group of people who are trying to follow Jesus in the city of Corinth. He spent a year and a half with them, but there's some challenges because they live in a culture and they have all kinds of baggage and they had a whole different philosophy on what life was all about before they became followers of Jesus. So Paul is now in Ephesus across the Aegean Sea and he is writing letters. And part of it is just to correct kind of the messiness of people trying to follow Jesus. Last week, we looked at this whole idea that in the church, there were schisms and divisions, and they had internal friction. And he does this amazing thing. He starts to talk about the cross. That here's how we get along. We follow the example of Jesus to be humble and to be selfless and sacrificial. And that is actually the pathway towards humans staying in relationship rather than fracturing apart. And he actually brings it up. It's the foolishness of the cross. It just doesn't make sense. You win arguments by arguing louder and being more dominant. He says, no. This is how you win in relationships. You live like Jesus did, in a sacrificial fashion, in a humble fashion, in a selfless fashion. Now, in chapter 2, he is going to talk about his own motivations regarding what drove him when he originally came to Corinth. So this is a really interesting city. It's the most modern city in the Roman Empire at the time because it had been destroyed by Rome, left dormant for 102 years, and then been rebuilt by Julius Caesar. And we'll talk a little bit more about how he populates it. It's Julius Caesar's grand experiment in creating a brand new city, which adds to some of its challenges. But Paul's going to talk about the foolishness of his own preaching. Now, that's kind of an interesting thing, like the foolishness of your preaching. He's going to talk about his deepest motivations and what he is focused on. And I just got to warn you, we're going to read one half of one verse, and then you're going to think that I'm going on the most crazy rabbit trail of all time. But I really think it's going to help us to understand these first five verses of chapter 2, okay? I'll do my best to make it all come together, all right? You with me? Okay, let's read just the first verse of 1 Corinthians chapter 2, then we're going to go on our rabbit trail. You ready? And so it was with me, brothers and sisters, when I came to you. So when we read this, here's one thing I love. As we're studying the book of 1 Corinthians together, we have to ask good questions. I think a lot of times we're intimidated. We think, well, if I ask questions, does that mean I'm doubting? No. When you read the Bible, we should ask, well, what does that mean? Where were you before? When I came to you, Paul came to you from where? So we're going to go on this rabbit trail. We're going to look at what had happened just previous to Paul coming to Corinth. Okay, we're going to start by showing you a map. So in Acts chapter 17, and that's what we're going to read in a moment, Paul was in Athens. Athens is still a place where people visit today because it's a city that was filled with philosophy and the grandeur and architecture and temples to every god you can imagine. And it is 52 miles, and 52 miles, taking Paul 3, 4, 5 days to travel 52 miles. We know that from Acts chapter 17, he goes directly from Athens to Corinth. And he says, when I came to you. So let's take a moment and let's read about what happened before Paul came to Corinth, because it will help us to understand what he says in 1 Corinthians 2, 1 through 5. Okay, the book of Acts chronicles the early church. It chronicles what happened in Athens. It's written by this brilliant man named Luke. Let's read what happened before he came to Corinth. While Paul was waiting for them in, there's our city. He's waiting in Athens. He's waiting for his co-workers to join him. He was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So we know of somewhere around 37 different temples that existed in the ancient world in Athens. And then there are altars everywhere. This is an incredibly religious city. So he reasoned. Notice that word, very specific that Luke uses this. It means that he used the power of his intellect. He tried to convince people. He reasoned in the synagogue, which was the Jewish church that met on Saturdays with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as the marketplace. So Paul thought this, people just don't find God at a church service. I'm gonna go to the marketplace. I'm gonna go where people are selling and buying, and I'm gonna talk to them there day by day with those who happen to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Pause for a moment. These are two parties of philosophy who do not see the world the same way, but they are brilliant. Our word Stoic, like, have you ever heard anybody say like they're a very Stoic person? The Stoic philosophy was this, you rid yourselves of emotion. You just deal with the facts only. What you feel doesn't matter. Guys, some of you are like, ooh, I like this. I like this. So these brilliant people who are Stoics and these brilliant philosophers who are Epicurean, which is kind of the opposite of that, begin to, notice this word, debate. Okay, you have these two brilliant groups of philosophers and Paul, and they begin to like hash through, discuss, debate with him. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? Others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus. What's the Areopagus? Well, it's still there today. You can visit. I'd love one day, like, let's go together and visit the Areopagus. The Areopagus was the intellectual centerpiece of the world at that point. It was filled with schools and lectures and the most brilliant minds, the most brilliant philosophers all joined together at the Areopagus. And they sat and they taught and people learned. It'd be like if you took Oxford and Harvard and the three other top colleges in the whole world and you brought them into one place and you said, this is where we bring our most brilliant minds. So now Paul, this Jewish rabbi, is being invited to the Areopagus to stand in front of these brilliant people where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting. You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears and we would like to know what they mean. Luke, you can tell he's a very practical person. He says, all the Athenians and the foreigners who live there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. So Luke's like, just like, go do something, right? Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, people of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. He's appealing to this desire that they have to know the gods. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription to an unknown god. So there's hundreds of places of worship. And because they just want to make sure they had all their bases covered, they said, and there's probably some god we don't know about. So here's an altar to the unknown god. Just, you don't know what to call him or her. Just like come worship just so we make sure we don't miss any of the gods. So you're ignorant of the very thing you worship. You're saying by that you don't know everything about what God is doing or who he or she is. And this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. I'm going to tell you about your unknown God. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven
and earth. Big dramatic statement. There's not multiple gods out there, but there's a God who is the initiator and the creator, and they have all their different philosophies on how human life and how the world began. He says, I'm going to tell you that there is one God, and he began all of this and does not live in temples. Wait a minute. We build temples, and then we ask the gods to come reside, and we go find our gods in the temples. He says, he does not live in temples built by human hands, and he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. God, I'm going to tell you about, he doesn't need you. He's in charge. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. He was the creator, and now he's involved. The reason you are alive, it's because this God is still active in the world. From one man, he's referring to Adam, but he does not use Adam. From one man, he made all the nations. They should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. This God has overseen human development over the ages. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. He's going to quote Old Testament scripture, for in him we live and we move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said. Now he's going to quote ancient Greek poetry appealing to their intellect and their own history. We are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, for he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man. Okay, really interesting. He does not mention the name Jesus, but he mentions the work of Jesus by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him. Again, didn't mention Jesus, but raising him from the dead. Now, they're pretty interested at this point, but when you start talking about resurrection, right? Come on, are you serious? When they heard about this, the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, we want to hear you again on this subject. At that, Paul left the council. Some of the people became followers. It's really interesting. It's so different from the rest of Acts. It usually says they became followers or disciples of Jesus, but notice this, became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysus, a member of the Areopagus, and also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. Some of your Bible translations will actually say, and a few others. This is what happens. Right before Paul comes to Corinth, from here he leaves. He travels the 52 miles to Corinth. But what we're going to see is what he did in Corinth is radically different from what happened in Athens. Now, what do we learn from Paul coming to Athens? When I was a brand new pastor, I think it's probably 25, 26 years ago, I went to my first conference. And at the time, my wife and I were leading a church at the University of Oregon for university students. I was born and raised in rural Colorado. In third grade, I wore a cowboy hat to school every day. I was part of 4-H, okay? So I lived in this very conservative culture. My mom and dad were pastors after I got into middle school. And then I'm thrown to the University of Oregon, which I don't know if anybody knows about the University of Oregon, but like, it's crazy. Right, it's just like all new ideas, and you got to throw all the old stuff out of the window, and the air always smells like skunk. Some of you know what that means. And like it was wild. And I'm trying to figure out, how do we reach these pluralistic people, these postmodern people, these people that weren't raised going to Sunday school, these people who actually have a negative perception of what Christianity is. How do we reach them? So I went to my first conference ever, and the whole conference was based out of Acts chapter 17, and it was brilliant. And it was held up as this model for how to reach a pluralistic, non-traditionally Christian society, that you appeal to people's religious pursuits and that you understand their culture and that you develop a reasoned argument and you present it as well as you possibly possibly can to try to convince the philosophies of this age to rethink everything. So what we see from Acts chapter 17 is one, Paul's brilliance. I mean, to be able, can you imagine? Like none of us in the room are ready to go head to head with the most brilliant scholars of the day and to have a cohesive, comprehensive presentation of who God is. And Paul has the intellectual power to stand in the Areopagus. So there's a lot we learn from this. However, here's what I'm coming to think. I'm coming to think that Paul made a major change in his life after being in Athens. Because here's the problem. Luke says, there were some who became disciples of Paul, which is curious, because all throughout Acts, as they became disciples of Jesus. And then here's the other thing. It says that there were only a few people. In fact, I can name two of them, and there are a couple others. And here's the third thing. It's really different than almost every visit that Paul has to these major Roman cities. There's no church planted. Wherever Paul would go, sometimes he'd be chased out of town or sometimes he'd stay for a while. But the end result is there's this new pocket, this new community of followers of Jesus, and they form a church and they begin to grow together and they begin to interact with their society. In fact, if you look historically, we do not have a record of a Christian, an early Christian church in Athens until decades after this. So we could look at this and say, although what Paul did was utterly brilliant, it doesn't seem to be that effective. So here's my question. When Paul left Athens, after what might be considered a highlight, ability to stand in front of the most brilliant minds of the day and to present to them a partial view of who God is. Again, it didn't ever mention Jesus and it never mentions the cross. What was he thinking on his way to Corinth? There's no church there. Why does he present the message of Jesus so much differently when he gets to Corinth? Okay, with that question in mind, these 52 miles that Paul has to rethink what just happened in Athens. Now, let's read 1 Corinthians chapter 2. The rabbit trail is over. So it was with me, brothers and sisters. When I came to you, 52 miles away from Athens, I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved, somewhere between Athens and Corinth, I made a determination. I just made a decision. I resolved to know nothing while I was with you, except this: Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness, with great fear and trembling. Why? Paul doesn't even seem to be a little bit afraid to stand up at the Areopagus in Athens. But he says, when I came to you, I came with fear and humility and trembling. And my message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith may not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. Paul gives us his glimpse into this transformation that is happening in him and this brand new determination. I just want to take a few moments and I want to talk about proclamation. I want to talk about what drove Paul and how it can drive us. Number one, proclamation or preaching is for all disciples of Jesus. Okay? This word that Paul uses, when I came to you, I proclaimed. Now, here's the challenge in our culture. When we talk about proclamation or preaching, what do you think about? You think like, Nate, that's your job, right? Or that's the job of this other guy, or you know, there's all these churches meeting, and that's her job, that's his job. And we think, oh yeah, 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 like I come, somebody else preaches, okay? Here's the challenge with that. It's two words used for preaching in the New Testament. One is caruso, caruso. And caruso is to make known, it's to announce, it's to be a herald. It happens one-on-one, it happens in crowds. It's what Paul did in the synagogue, it's what Paul did in the marketplace. And the challenge with this word is this. In the New Testament, it's for everybody who has had a profound life-changing experience with Jesus. It is what Jesus says to 500 people who he spends time with after the resurrection. He looks at them and he says, now I want all of you to go into all the world and preach, caruso, communicate, be the embodiment of the message. I want all of you to live a life that communicates something of who God is. I want your words to describe who he is to all nations, okay? So preaching is for everybody. Now, the other word that's used is didasco. And didasco is different. It's instruction. It's helping people learn. It's theology and doctrine. So actually what I am doing right here is didasco. You guys say, okay, Nate, you need to make sure that you do something during your week so that when I come to church, when I tune in on the internet, you can help me understand the Bible. Okay, that's my job in large part. That's what I'm called to do. And this isn't for everybody. Certain people have a calling to it. Certain people have a gifting towards it. And then you nurture it and you try to help people, right? So when we say preaching, we have to understand that it's this word, that it's for everyone. So what are the implications of this? The implications are that everybody is called to be a herald, a communicator, a declarer. It's called to embody and live out the message of Jesus. So this is super, super corny, but it just has to be done. You've got to look at the person on your right and your left, and you got to go, you're a preacher. You are a preacher, right? Now, there's a few of you who are like, give me the mic. Give me the megaphone. I'm ready for this. But there are a vast majority of us who are like, you don't know what happened my sophomore year of high school during speech class where I wet my pants and I didn't notice it, but I had toilet paper attached to the bottom of my shoe and I was utterly humiliated and my speech, it was supposed to take 2 minutes, took 3 seconds and I flunked it and I cannot talk to people. If you are afraid when I say that every disciple of Jesus is called to be a preacher, you're in great company. Because what does Paul say? I came to you with fear and trembling. And I think he's talking about what happened in Athens. I gave it my best. And there was no church afterwards. So after walking these 52 miles to Corinth, I was terrified. I was trembling when I entered into your city and began to talk to you about the person of Jesus. If you're afraid, that's natural. But everybody, maybe you're not even sure what you believe. Hey, the minute you become spiritually resolved, you're invited to be part of the way that God is gonna communicate who he is and what he's doing on planet Earth. Everyone is called to preach. Now here's the challenge with that. Oftentimes the way we think about church is this. Okay, let's build a big enough building so that you can get all your friends who don't yet know Jesus to come into the room and then Nate, you don't embarrass me, but give a clear, compelling presentation of who Jesus is, okay? And that happens at times. And I'm grateful for that. And I want you to bring your friends. But that is a horribly inefficient way to carry out the work of Jesus. You know the best way to carry out the work of Jesus is? is that in 20 minutes, I don't know, hundreds of disciples of Jesus who are preachers, heralds, communicators of who he is, go back to their apartment complexes and their divisional playoff parties later today, and then on Monday, go to their law offices and their schools and their job sites and embody the message of Jesus and have words of hope and life. Everybody is called to be a preacher. Point number two. The gospel is about going to people. Okay, this fits with the previous one. So gospel means good news, good news. It's about going to people. Paul introduces it this way: when I came to you, when I came to you. He says, it is not the job of people who are asking questions about who God is to find me. It's not their job to find the church. It is our job to go, right? So do you notice like every single service we dismiss the same way? You know, it's totally repetitive. And I'm just gonna keep on repeating it. Now go and be the hands and the feet and the mouthpiece of Jesus. Because the goal is not to get the people in the church. The goal is to get the church to the people, right? So it's go. This is how Jesus started everything out. He looked at his disciples. He said, now go. He didn't say like build a really big building and make it so amazing that everyone wants to come. Create such an amazing environment that you have to like add more services. He says, this is my goal, is that you go into all the world. Hey, sometimes that's over an ocean. Sometimes that's across the street. You go into all the world. So the gospel is always about when we want to preach, when we communicate, it's about us initiating, not sitting in, around and waiting for people to go, hey, maybe I should check out Jesus. Here's the third thing. Share the good news out of our weakness. It's the best way to share the good news. So Paul says this, when I came to you, and I came in my weakness. I came potentially with my tail between my legs because of what just happened at Athens. So here's what we typically think. We think if God could use us, he'd probably use the best part of us, right? He'd probably use our charm, our intellect. He'd use our good looks. He'd use our friendliness. He'd use our persuasive words. He'd use these, like, I've got a great work ethic. If God's gonna use me, he's gonna use me through my strengths. But I am telling you that God typically uses us through our weaknesses. Paul says, I came to you in weakness. When we are vulnerable, people listen. When we are real, people remember that. Because the world is looking for authenticity. Every human being I know is dealing with this question: what is wrong with me? How can I fix what is broken in me? I've got proof of this. Whenever I tell a story, an illustration, if I tell a story and it has to do with my strengths, nobody remembers it. If I tell a story or an illustration from my life and it involves my weakness, you all remember it and you bring it up forever. Like, you're a terrible dad too. Like, I love that. About 2 years ago, you talked about like what a jerk you were to your wife. That's so good. I'm like, why do people only remember that? Why? Because we learn from our weakness. And so Paul's saying this, I limped into Corinth, and I didn't bring the A game that I had in Athens, and I just presented you what was broken. Somebody the other day, this has happened to me a lot of times in life, somebody, I was talking to them about faith, and they just looked at me and they said, well, for you, Nate, Christianity is a crutch. And I have the same answer every time. I go, oh, no, 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 it's much worse than that. It's not a crutch. It's like a gurney. It's an ambulance. Like, I needed to have the paddles. Like, Christianity isn't a crutch to help me function. Christianity is the only thing that's made me alive. I'm still hooked up to IVs and monitors everywhere. Without Jesus, I'm like dead. I have nothing to offer the world whatsoever. And when you can like realize that it's not up to me to present the best of who I am, but when you present, when you preach the gospel and you talk about, hey, when I met Jesus, can I tell you what I was like? I was just recently divorced. I was an addict. I was in so much pain because of the trauma I'd experienced. I was so depressed. I was so forlorn. I was so greedy. I was so angry. You know what God did? He began to change that. When we present the gospel out of our weakness rather than out of our strength and our brilliance and all of our gifting, it's terribly authentic. Paul says, I came to you out of my weakness. Point number four, when it comes to preaching, teaching, caruso, the best apologetic for the gospel, the good news, is a changed life, okay? Apologetic, I know it's a little bit of a funny term. It's typically used to a defense of the gospel, a reasoned presentation. And so there are brilliant apologetics alive today, and they have that capacity to... They do research and they can help somebody understand that the Bible is actually this brilliant, cohesive book that contains truth and it's not confusing and not filled with error. They can help present ideas for why Christianity is actually a very reasonable faith when you look at world philosophies. So sometimes we think like what we need is we just need more facts, right? If I just knew more, I'd be able to communicate the message of Jesus better. I love apologetics, but most people that love apologetics are already Christians, right? I don't know anybody who's far from God who loves apologetics. It just helps me confirm that, yeah, this is a real deal. The best defense of the gospel is this: a demonstration of the Spirit's power. We don't even have a record of a single miracle that happened in Corinth. So I don't think it was Paul saying, when I came, like all these people were healed and, you know, crowds were fed. I think what he's saying is this: I came to you, there were people who were so broken, so fractured. And God began to transform their lives. This was a demonstration that this isn't just a philosophy, this whole adopting the teachings of Jesus, that this is actually real and transformative. And people began to see that this wasn't another human philosophy. They didn't become, what, students or disciples of Paul? They realized that what God is doing has the capacity to take people who are addicts and help them find freedom, to people who are so broken that they can't bear to live another day, to the place where he gives them hope. The very best apologetic proclamation that you and I can give to this world is allow God to transform us. Because when somebody looks at you and says, you are the meanest, greediest son of a gun I'd ever met, you're different now. Nobody knows how to change in this world. How many of the books, how many of the messages are out there? Like, you got to find a way to change yourself. What if God can change us? What if people look at my life and go like, you can't be the same person. What happened to you? Lastly, number five, never stray from the center. Jesus Christ, never stray. This scripture meant a lot to my wife this year. It has kept me on track this year because I always have opinions on everything in this world, right? What a privilege I have to stand in front of you, and I could try to convince you to view politics the way I view politics, to view anything. Paul says, after Athens, I resolved to know nothing while I was with you. except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I am not going to be distracted. I'm not going to be resolved to try to win the argument. I'm not going to be resolved to try to be right. Here's the one thing Paul says that I'm resolved. I'm resolved somehow as I journeyed from Athens to Corinth. I came to this conclusion. The most important thing for me to present to the church, the potential church in Corinth, is this: Jesus and him crucified. I could tell them about this cohesive presentation that I gave the Athenians about this God who keeps all things together. I could tell them, I could be resolved that we all have to view Genesis 1 and 2 the exact same way, and that we have to view end times this way, and we have to view politics this way. But I resolve this: the only thing that was really important, the only thing that is essential, is the fact that God came to planet Earth, our creator. And he said, you can't save yourselves, so I will become a human being and I will die so that you could be reconnected. I'll find a way to deal with all the brokenness and hurt within your lives. And then I'll be resurrected so that you can live again, so that human beings and God can be in harmony once again. He said, I resolved, I'm not gonna talk about anything else. Jesus Christ and him crucified. Always, please, 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 always stay centered on Jesus Christ and him crucified.
We hope that this helps you take your next step on your spiritual journey. If you'd like to get involved with the work and ministry of Faith Chapel, visit faithchapel.cc and click on Next Steps. If you'd like to speak to a pastor or connect with us in any way, email connect@faithchapel.cc. We look forward to connecting with you soon.